So today we're going to talk about parables. And the question that I'm going to begin with is, do you ever sit down and digest parables? Do you ever sit down and digest parables? As you look at parables, there are lots of different parables that we find in the scriptures, and especially in the gospels we find them. We have long parables, short parables. We have clear parables. We have hard to discern parables, and there are parables that are explained, and there are parables that aren't explained. So we have a variety of parables that we can choose from and sit down and seek to examine them and determine what God is trying to tell us through the parable. But the question is, have you sat down and really tried to digest a parable? And that is to see how much truth there is in there, and the lessons that God includes in that particular parable. And all of the parables share one thing in common. They are all valuable for instruction and for spiritual understanding. So I hope to show you in the sermon that this particular parable that we'll examine is most definitely valuable for instruction and spiritual understanding. Before I do that, I'd like to ask four questions that we'll seek to answer in the sermon, because they're subheads to the information that I'll be covering. The first question is this: as you read through the book of Matthew, what is the first parable given by Jesus Christ in Matthew? What is the first parable? Now, that's not going to take you very long to answer that. Some of you may know it, anyway, we'll answer that here shortly. The second question is also a pretty short question that won't take you long to answer. Do you remember the disciples' response to that parable? Christ gave the parable, and his disciples had a response to it. Do you remember what that response was? The third question is going to take longer to answer, because it is a philosophical question that we'll be answering. So when you hear philosophical, don't get all worried. It will explain what I mean by philosophical. And the third question is, what philosophical position of our church is anchored in the explanation of that parable? What philosophical position of our church is anchored in the parable, in the explanation of that parable? And finally, we'll look at the lessons that we can learn from the parable. So we're going to go through those four questions and answer them, and hopefully you'll find this valuable. The first parable in the book of Matthew is the parable of the sower, found in Matthew chapter 13. And let's begin in Matthew chapter 13, verse 1. There it says, on the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea, and great multitudes were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. Then he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow. Now, at the time that Christ was speaking to this crowd, he had taken up residence in the city of Capernaum. And as it says in the parable, he went out of the city, and he got into a boat, and from that boat he spoke to the crowd. And the reason that he got into the boat is because the crowd tended to push up around him, and all these people are crowded around you and sort of crushing you. So in the boat, he's free from that. And also, being in the boat and being able to speak to the crowd on the shore, he was able to use the best natural amplification system possible, where they could hear him and hear him clearly. The second question I posed at the outset was, what was the disciples' response in the parable? To the parable, what did they have to say about it? As I said, this is the first parable recorded in Matthew, and it took Jesus all of 6.5 verses to give the parable. He gave the parable to the audience, and when he was finished, his disciples came to him and asked a very serious question, and they asked in chapter 13, verse 10, why do you speak to them in parables? Why do you speak to them in parables? Why are you doing this? What's your motive? Why would you speak to these people in parables? And the reason the disciples asked the question, why are you doing this, is because they recognized that the audience had no clue what he was talking about. It didn't resonate with them at all. So they're all wondering, why would you take this approach when you're speaking to these people? So if you were to read verses 10 through 17, you would find something else. You would find that not only did the audience not understand what Christ was saying to them in the parable, but neither did the disciples. So Christ gives this parable, the disciples don't understand, and the crowd on the shore don't understand it either. So when you're speaking to people, why would you speak to them in that way when nobody gets it? So we've addressed the two short questions I posed. Now we'll move on to the third question, and that is, what philosophical position of the church is anchored in the explanation of this parable? Those of you who are familiar with the parable, which is most of us here today listening, he gave the parable and the disciples asked him, why did he speak to them in parables? And then he then explained the rationale, and he also explained the parable. So he explains why he did it this way, and he explains the parable to them. So there are four pieces to this puzzle, and the question before us, what is the philosophical position of the United Church of God that is supported by this parable? In every teaching, as you look at them, there are distinct levels of importance, and the United Church of God holds doctrine as something that's very important. In fact, we came into being as a church over the issue of doctrine. We felt the doctrines were being watered down, were being undermined and cast away, and so we came about as an organization in order to defend those doctrines and to continue following those, learning those doctrines and sharing them with others. So as we assemble to carry out the mission of the church, we look at ourselves as a body for whom doctrine is very important, and as well it should be. What do we believe and why do we believe it? But there are components to our faith that are even more important and more significant than doctrine, and those are our philosophies. Now, when you hear philosophy, for many of us, that's a little bit worrisome. Okay, where are we going with this philosophy idea? But just so you know, I'll point to it. This plaque right here gives you two basic philosophies of the United Church of God. Do you all know what those are? One is preparing a people, and the second one is preaching the gospel. Two philosophies, preaching the gospel, preparing a people. So those are basic philosophies of the United Church of God, and the doctrines that we believe support those two philosophies. So those are things that basic things that we believe. So when I asked the question about the parable of the sower and the major philosophical cornerstone that is put in place within that parable, we are looking at something upon which multiple doctrines rest. And what is it? Well, the answer to that question is found in verses 10, 11, and 13. It's found in verses 10, 11, and 13. Chapter 13, verse 10 says, "And the disciples came and said to him, 'Why do you speak to them in parables?' And he answered them, 'Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven.' But to them, the audience that was there on the shore, it has not been given. So you, my disciples that I called, this is open to your understanding. But I speak to them in parables so that they can't understand." And he explains that more fully, beginning in verse 13. He says, "Therefore I speak to them in parables, because in seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, and nor do they understand. So when you looked at Christ speaking to the audience here, they could see, they could hear Christ clearly. It wasn't a matter of they didn't understand what he was saying. They could hear the words, but the words did not register with them. So they see Christ, they note that he's talking to them, and what he's saying, they don't get. They don't get it, because the disciples recognized by the reaction of the audience that they didn't get it. So they question Christ, why are you doing this? Why are you talking to them knowing that they don't get it? And Christ is telling them what? That was my intent and purpose, that they wouldn't get it. Now that seems strange, doesn't it? So he did not intend for them to get it. But he did intend for the disciples to get it. And they didn't get it just by hearing, just by seeing. They didn't understand it. He had to explain it in more detail to them, and I would venture to say they still didn't get it after he gave them more insight into his point. So in this very small portion of the parables of Jesus Christ is a huge philosophical foundation of our faith. It's a foundational principle. And it is a principle that most of you know when I get fully get to explain it. And this is not the only location where this foundational principle is given here in Matthew chapter 13. In fact, if you need additional support to what I'm telling you, you can look in Isaiah, and Isaiah expounds the point. And you can also look in John chapter 6, one of the most quoted verses we have from the book of John. John chapter 6, beginning in verse 43. And Christ reiterates the principle. It's stated a little bit differently than the way it is in the parable. John chapter 6, verse 43 says, Jesus therefore answered and said to them, do not murmur among yourselves. So, okay. And then he says in verse 44, no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. So in John chapter 6, verse 44, he's making the same point that he made in Matthew chapter 13. And basically the point is, I call whom I wish to call. I call whom I wish to call, and I do not allow an understanding to those that I have not chosen to call. And that is a basic philosophical principle of the church. He said to the disciples, to you it has been given to understand. And he goes on and talks about this in Matthew chapter 13, verse 16. There he says, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. So God was allowing them to see and them to hear, which the crowd couldn't do. They couldn't see, they couldn't hear. Verse 17, for assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. So he said to his disciples, I intend that you understand what I teach. I want you to understand it. And you ask me why I spoke this way to the multitudes, and my response to you is, I did not intend for them to get it. That when you realize that, that's exactly what he said in Matthew 13, that seems a little bit hard to accept. Seems a little bit hard to accept, because what's the point to preaching to people if you are speaking to them in a way they can't understand? But there is a purpose behind it. So, you know, we as human beings, we've all had people talk to us and tell us something, and we've said, well, I just don't get it. I just don't see the point you're getting at. We've all gone through that. We're unable to wrap our minds around whatever it is they're talking about. And he is basically saying, I don't intend that they should see. So the crowd heard, but they did not understand what he was saying. So he tells the disciples, you have been given the opportunity to understand the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. It's not been given. Now, this is a major philosophical understanding of the United Church of God. And it's a major difference from most of Christianity. Almost universally across the Christian world, it is agreed that Jesus Christ is the firstborn Son of God. And that his place, his role, his description of himself in that capacity is not argued. Basically, most Christians accept the basic premises. It's the cornerstone of most of Christianity that Jesus Christ came as the Son of God. He was crucified for the sins of the world. He was buried in the tomb, or placed in the tomb, and rose from the grave in 3 days and three nights. And he returned to heaven to sit at God's right hand. And that's where he is to this very day. He was the firstborn from the dead. So, and at this point, with those things laid out as premises that are accepted in Christianity, there's a big divergence. There's a big divergence between Christianity and the church. A big divergence, and there's a reason for that. And for us to say that God did not intend them to get it is something that a lot of people perceive as a great deal of arrogance on our part. You know, to go out and tell people, God's called me, but not you. I get it, you don't, because God has not given to it, you the opportunity to understand the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. So most people aren't going to be real thrilled with that explanation. It's true, but it's an explanation that is hard for people to accept. So it's our belief that God has called a very small portion of humanity to understand the truth throughout the history of the world, going all the way back to Adam and Eve. There are very few that have understood down throughout history. They just have not understood it. And we believe that But we have an understanding beyond that, which is very different from the understanding that the world comes to because of the way things are. And we walk in very different directions from them. I've read to you Christ's answer to the disciples, which is pretty clear cut, but that particular, what Christ said, the world doesn't accept. Now, how do we know that they don't accept it? Well, we're going to look at some quotes from a couple of different commentaries that are commonly used by English speakers, and it's interesting what they have to say, because we noted what Christ said, didn't he? It's not given to them to understand. But then what do these educated individuals who have put together these commentaries have to say? First of all, I'll quote from Jameson Fawcett Brown, addressing the question of why Jesus speaks in parables. And he says, therefore, though before this he had couched some things in parabolic form, for more vivid illustration, it would appear now for the first time formerly employed this method of teaching. So he said that these parables are being given to more vividly illustrate the point that Christ is making. So if you more vividly illustrate something, isn't it so they can understand? But that's not what Christ said, is it? That's not what he said. But here's Jameson Fawcett Brown making this point that that's what Jesus was doing with the parables, was making it more understandable to the crowd. Another quote in Matthew Henry has a little bit more antiquated language, and he says, what he spoke was in parables. A parable sometimes signifies any wise, weighty saying that is instructive. But here in the Gospels, it generally signifies a continued similitude or comparison by which spiritual or heavenly things were described in language borrowed from things of this life. So we would agree with that. We would agree that to make a point, you speak in a parable and you use things that people are familiar with in order to make the point. And we wouldn't disagree with that. Then it says, it was a way of teaching used very much, not only by the Jewish rabbis, but by the Arabians and by other wise men of the East. And we wouldn't disagree with that either. Picture yourself in a world, you know, back in that time, it was a different world. And there's no mass media, no TV, no radio, no music, no telephones, no computers. So you're having dinner, and what did you do? You didn't watch TV, didn't watch the news, you talked. And one of the things that was common in that time was to ask riddles and give quizzes and offer parables. And these were just common things that were part of conversation. Well, what do you think this means? And you would quiz the others on it. But if you go back to Samson's time, riddles, or, you know, you find parables or riddles being used, and that was just common to the time. We don't do that. So, you know, most of you are not asking these kinds of questions at the dinner table, but that would have been more common back in that time. Let me finish what Matthew Henry had to say. It was a way of teaching used very much, not only by the Jewish rabbis, but by Arabians and by other men of the East. It was found to be very profitable. And you might ask, well, if it's such a profitable thing, why was it not understood? It may not be as profitable as Matthew Henry is saying here. Matthew Henry goes on to and removes all doubt. He says, therefore he preached by parables, because thereby the things of God were made more plain and easy to them who were willingly ignorant. These people were ignorant from a biblical point of view. So what he's saying is Christ did this, he gave these parables in order to make it easier for them to understand. So that seems unusual. It seems, you mean, Matthew Henry did not understand what Christ was saying? Why would he say such a thing? Because it contradicts what Christ said. Why would he do that? It's not even intellectually honest. So there's a reason for that, because it has to do with the philosophy by which Matthew Henry and Jameson Fawcett Brown operated. So what philosophy did they operate under? They operated under the philosophy that God is a gracious and merciful God, and it is God's intention to save the world here and now. So from the time of Adam and Eve, God has wanted to save the world, and so he has wanted people to understand, and that was their one opportunity. Whenever they lived, whenever it was, before the flood, or back in the time of Israel, that was your opportunity. And if you did not get it, and you did not accept Christ, you're lost. Okay, that's the point they're coming from. So Matthew Henry and Jameson Fawcett Brown are supporting their premise, and they're telling you God is a merciful, a just, a gracious God, and he's seeking to help these people to better understand, when that's not what Christ said at all. So, and as you look at the Apostle Paul, Paul makes the same point in a more elaborate form, speaking of it in Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11. And he tells us in those chapters, you know, I wish that my nation, the people of Judah, would respond to the gospel. And he says, my relations, my national relations, they're very zealous for God. They're zealous for God. They seek to understand, but they don't have understanding. They're zealous, but they don't have understanding. He also points out that, yes, this is the case. They don't see it, but there will come a time when they will. There will come a time when God, you looked at the people of Israel, they were cut off from the tree, but God says, I'm going to graft them back in. And what he's done is he's grafted in the Gentiles, but we also know that God's not calling all of the Gentiles either. But he gave the Gentiles the opportunity, some of them, to understand and to be a part of his family. So we went to the feast this year. We've just recently come back from the feast, and we reviewed the fall holy days, didn't we? And we saw that God's plan to offer salvation is a plan that encompasses all people that have ever lived from Adam and Eve forward. And that's the point of the holy days. Yes, God calls out, but God also has a plan to incorporate everybody into his plan and to give everybody the chance to be a part of his family someday. So, we will once again begin that educational cycle with the holy days in the spring of 2022. So God's holy days remind us that blindness to God and his plan is only a temporary situation, that eventually everybody will understand. But if you just stop and look at where we're at today, it seems God's unfair. But God's not unfair. God is going to work out his plan in the way that is going to open the way to salvation for everyone. And he reminds us of that in Jeremiah chapter 31. Jeremiah chapter 31 in verse 34. And it's talking about a future event, a future reality. Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 34, it says, no more shall every man teach his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. That seems to say everybody. That's eventually to come about. All of them, from the least to the greatest, for I will forgive their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more. And many of us have heard the following words from professing Christians. If you've been around long enough, you've probably heard them. Have you ever had anybody come up to you and say, do you know the Lord? I have. I mean, I've been on the beach in California, laying there on my beach towel, and people come walking along the beach, do you know Jesus? And I didn't reply, but a friend of mine was there, and he was kind of a difficult person. He said, do you? Have you been talking to him? And he was kind of a scoffer and giving them a hard time. But I remember him doing that. But that was more common back when I was a teenager, that you would hear, do you know the Lord? Have you accepted Jesus as your Savior? Have you been saved? If you've been around long enough, you've heard all of those things. What's interesting is that you don't hear those things so much anymore. Our society has changed, and where people were more open about those things in the past, we don't hear those words. I don't hear them at all, but again, my office is in my home, and even on the street, I don't hear people asking you those questions. And I think it's an indicator of where we're at as a society, that those questions aren't even being addressed. So I realize that in our theology, we believe in something that in the normal world of Christianity is considered too good to be true, that all people are going to have the opportunity to know God and his way of life, the opportunity for salvation. That's too good to be true. And the most common retort as we explain our position is what? Well, they're all getting a second chance. If you've ever tried to explain what we believe, people say, well, they're getting a second chance. That's not fair. And the question is, are they getting a second chance. That's how it seems, but that's not the case at all. We're not giving, you know, they say you're giving them a second chance. Well, no, we're not. God is. And he's not giving them a second chance. He's giving them a first chance when you really understand the fact that they did not understand. So we have to keep in mind that just because someone draws breath does not mean that they have, that is their chance. Because most people that have had the breath of life did not have a chance. They didn't know. They did not know. And I remember my wife worked with this lady, and basically her point of view was that if you don't, you can hear it now, and somehow, some way, you're going to hear it and be given the opportunity to respond. And if you don't, you're going to burn in hell forever. So she was pretty adamant about that. And so anyway, and there was no arguing with her on that particular point. So, you know, for me, and I think for most of us, we believe what Jesus Christ had to say in Matthew chapter 13. If God blinds the person, if God stops their ears and inhibits their understanding, how can we say a person has had a chance? But there will be a come a time when they will have a chance. What Jesus says in Matthew 13 refutes the whole evangelical approach to modern Christianity. And as I said, what they believe is that God is a gracious God, and God is trying to save the world now. And having that belief, what are they doing? They're going out and they're seeking to get people to turn to God. And they're sincere, they're dedicated. You've had all sorts of people who've gone into some really dangerous situations, life or death situations, in order to share the gospel, what they believe is the gospel of Jesus Christ, and help people to come to Christ. So they've been dedicated to that. And they've made great sacrifices. And as you look at Matthew Henry or Jameson Fawcett Brown, why do they say something that refutes what Jesus said? It's because they are supporting the philosophy of their religious belief. They're supporting it. So they can't say what Jesus said is the truth. They have to refute it. They have to put it in different words that actually go against what Jesus said. Because if they accept what Jesus said, then they have to say God is not merciful. God is not gracious. God is not a loving God. Because if you don't come to Christ at this time, you're lost. So that's their point of view. And unfortunately, you know, when you have what Christ said and you're refuting it, basically what you're doing is you are saying the end justifies the means. I want Jesus to be saying this. Therefore, if I misrepresent what he's saying, it's for a good purpose. Maybe in the sense of you want them to receive salvation, but if you're misrepresenting what God said, I don't think that's a good purpose. But they can't see beyond it, and many people over the ages has had the idea the end justifies the means. So if I lie, it's for a good purpose. And you have to ask yourself, can you lie for a good purpose? I don't think so. Because as you look at that short statement, you shall not bear false witness, it doesn't say except under these circumstances. There's no deal there that says, well, if this is the case, you can do it, you can lie. No, there's no lie. You can't do that. So as you look at what is presented in Matthew chapter 13, it is the philosophical position of the church, which is the plan of salvation is progressive. It's being worked out. There have been people who have been called throughout the ages. There are people that are being called now. And eventually the way is going to be open for all to come to God. For all to have the books of the Bible opened, for all to have God's Spirit. And most people will choose the path to follow God. But that's yet to come. It's not in this particular age. So let's come to the fourth point I mentioned. What are the lessons in the parables from which we can learn? What are the lessons in the parable that from which we can learn? In Matthew chapter 13, verse 18, it says there, "Therefore hear the parable of the sower." So Christ is saying, I told you, they were, in other words, so he goes through this and lays it out for the audience, and we know that the audience didn't understand because they didn't have the ears to hear. And so the sower went out sowing seeds, and the seed falls on different types of ground. And depending on the type of ground it falls on, the better it does. Matthew 13, verse 19. It says, "When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received the seed by the wayside." So we have to realize that a lot of people have heard the gospel. A lot of people in Christ's time heard the gospel, but they didn't understand what it was all about. And in our time, since 1933, millions of people have heard the gospel. Millions of people have read about the gospel. And the effort that we made to share the gospel went out. But of all those people who heard it, all of those people that were exposed to it, how many of them responded? How many of them responded? Sadly, we had a certain level of response, but was that response true? I mean, were those people truly responding and converted? Sadly, many of them were not, as things sorted out in 1995. So we have that tiny fraction with whom the message of the gospel resonated. Just a tiny fraction of people that God opened their minds to understand. And many of the people who heard it, they may have initially responded, but they didn't stick with it. And why did I respond to it? The first time I heard the church was when I was driving across the United States. It's middle of the night. I'm listening to it on the radio. I think it was out of Denver, and I heard it. And I think it was Garner Ted Armstrong at the time is speaking, and he's talking about the kingdom. And what he said, I thought, wow, that's amazing. So I remember trying to find something to, you know, and they're saying, call, write P.O. Box, whatever it was, and I'm trying to get something to write it down as I'm tooling along on Interstate 40 and at a high rate of speed and hoping not to crash my car. Wasn't wise enough to pull off, but anyway, I'm trying to find some way to write this down, and, you know, that was it. I heard the voice. And I didn't know what was, you know, never did make contact. But eventually, I heard it again because somebody came up and talked to me about it. So I did hear that, and I did begin to tune in and receive the literature of the church. But God gave me that initial opportunity to hear, but I wasn't able to do anything with it. And then God came back later on, and through somebody that was an acquaintance in college, I began to understand what God was talking about. But you know, as you look at the billions of people living on the earth, why me? Why you? And as you look at the disciples that were following Jesus Christ, were they the all-stars of the world of Judea? I don't think so. Christ called them for his purpose and worked with them just as he called us and works with us. So, and what happens with most people is they hear the gospel And it may, in a sense, intrigue them, and they begin to act on it a little bit. But one of the things you have to realize is that Satan realizes that too. And Satan will swoop in and use some method to undermine them. And having visited with people in the heyday of the church, you know, go visit with them, and they had different levels of understanding. And it's surprising the people that would come along. We went to visit this one lady, and she has a little kid, and the little kid's there, and he's just out of control. So we're sitting there talking to this lady, and this little kid is getting into the refrigerator and getting a big chunk of cheese, and he's throwing the cheese around in the house, and we're kind of like, wow, look at that. And, you think, when you get back in the car, you think, this lady will never come along in the church. And as soon as you say that, you know this lady is going to come along in the church. It had nothing to do with we could call it, because God's the one who makes the call. But, you know, you would see that and you think, it's never going to happen. But sure enough, it's God. And God is the one who's in power, and God that can help somebody come along. And, you know, a lot of times when people came into the church, one of the unfortunate things was they saw people in the church. And the people in the church, unfortunately, did not live up to the standard that God lays out. And what they would say is they're hypocrites. And for a lot of people, when they saw that humanity, these people are hypocrites. If they're hypocrites, I don't want anything to do with this. It's not real. It's not genuine. And so they could just cast it off. And I remember one guy that was interested in the church, and he was very intelligent, and he believed in evolution. And he had a certain perspective on things, and I tried to say, well, you got to look at some other things that are part of the answer here. But he couldn't get past it. We all evolve. Well, anyway, you can't, if their mind is set, it's hard to turn them around. And unfortunately, they can see what the church says, and they can all see what supposedly science says, and therefore they can discard it. So there have been tens of millions of people that have been exposed to the truth, but most of them have not responded to it and become members of the church. So that's the reality we have. So the gospel message can begin to take root, but the ground is not very deep, and it doesn't go very far. And you've got millions and millions of people who never got off the ground as far as the truth. So someone hears the kingdom, and they're trying to grasp it, and Satan comes along and undermines them in some way. And he's got a vast array of tools in order to accomplish that. So it never really takes up residence in their hearts, and they go on and never respond. It doesn't mean they're lost. It just means in this age, God has not called them out. Next, we come to Matthew chapter 13, verse 5, and it says, some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched because they had no root, and they withered away. So Christ then went on to explain that. He says, yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. So why is this person so short-lived in the faith? Two reasons: tribulation and persecution. And the person in this case meets obstacles. Either somebody that's pushing on him to give it up, or he meets obstacles in his life. And it always surprised me the obstacles that would come up. You know, I remember one guy said, well, I was doing fine, and then my old girlfriend showed up, and that just changed the whole perspective on things. So he never went forward. But he had some understanding. And you have individuals that come to know the truth or begin to believe the truth, and then they'll be persecuted. You know, how many people have told their boss, you know, this man, I got to keep the Sabbath. This is on Saturday. I can't work on Saturday anymore. And you go in and tell your boss that. And what does he say? Wow, I'm glad that you've come across the gospel and that you're willing to commit to it. You're going to be a part of God's family. You know that's what they say, isn't it? No, they don't say that at all. They say, well, here's the story. You have to work Friday nights and you have to work Saturdays. So if you aren't here, you're out. And there are 1,000 guys on the street wanting your job. So it's up to you. So what do you think most people do? Well, maybe I'm not going to do that. Or you have a spouse who says, if you do that, it's over. Those are serious challenges. So as people face tribulation or persecution, maybe God is helping, trying to reach them, but they can't break through. They can't get past it, and they go on about their way. And again, they're not lost. They just don't happen to have been called, and they've yielded to what they've heard and moved forward with it. And there are lots of people in that category as well. And the third category we find here in the parable of the sower is found in Matthew 13, verse 22. It says, and now he who received seed among the thorns is he who hears the word. And the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. So if he becomes unfruitful, that tells you that at some point he had become fruitful. And it says that because of the deceitfulness of riches and the cares of the world, he's become unfruitful. So what's happened is the riches and the cares of the world have become more important. So people get excited about the Bible and the truths that are there, and they begin pursuing them, and then they have to deal with, well, I can't take that I'm not going to get a raise because I'm doing this Saturday thing, or I'm going to lose out on the opportunity to make more money, and all of that, and people give it up. People give it up. And it's challenging. The deceitfulness of riches. Many of us know people that have become caught up in the pursuit of wealth and all of that, and they give up on the truth. Where it was a priority at one time, it's no longer a priority. And the thing that God is emphasizing, we have to make conscious choices about whether to pursue God or not. So if God calls us and brings us to repentance, and the seed of the gospel begins to, it's planted in our lives and it begins to grow. And like it says, it begins to grow, and it says it can give, you know, it can produce 30, 60, 100. It begins to produce. Well, whether we produce or not is going to be up to us. God's not going to do it for us. And there are various challenges that can come our way that test us to whether we will be faithful. As you look at Matthew chapter 13, verse 23, this is where it talks about those who hear the word and understand it, and who indeed bear fruit and produce, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. And these verses tie in with Matthew chapter 25 and Luke chapter 19. And what's God looking for? For most of us, we're busy. We're busy, 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 busy. And God said, well, I'm glad you're busy. But the question is, you're busy, but are you able to put some effort into responding to my word and bearing fruit? So when God, when Christ returns, we stand before him, he's not going to say, so what did you produce? Well, you know, I was really busy. That's not going to be the answer he's looking for. That's not what he's looking for. And he's not looking for, your having established a bank account, in the sense of a bank account at the time that Christ was speaking was burying it in the ground. So you had the money, there were no banks, so what did you do? You put it in the ground, in the box or whatever. And then, you know, for the well-to-do, they put it in the temple. But most people didn't have access to that. So what did they do? They buried it in the ground. And God's not, and if you've buried it in the ground, you're not going to produce much. So God says, I want to see what you produced, and you have the opportunity to produce. So we want to be busy doing God's will and doing God's work and responding to his truth. And so we want to be productive, and when God has us before him, we can say, here's what I've produced. Not to brag, but because you intervened and worked in my life, I've produced these things. Now, so as you look at this, I asked as we began the sermon, have you ever sought to digest a parable? That is, you read it, you study it, you look for different bits of information about it, and then you can take that to heart and you can apply it in your own life. And if you've never done that, it's well worthwhile doing so. And what we've done here today is we've sought to digest a parable. So you have an example of what you can do if you dig into God's word and seek to understand it. This wasn't all new truth, but what you see is that there's more depth there sometimes than we see. And it's good to step back and think about it and seek to better understand it and apply it in your life. So I hope what we've gone through today will be an impetus for you to dig deeper and to digest the parables that Christ has given to us.